My name is Angie Brown, and you are listening to the Being Luminary podcast, the podcast where I get into all things diversity, equity, and inclusion with luminary guests, a sprinkling of coaching, advice, guidance, and the inspiration for you to do things differently in your organization. If you want to create a luminary place to work, a luminary experience for your clients, your teams, your communities, if you are committed to overleaping compliance and heading straight for luminary approaches to DEI, you are in the right place. You are listening to the Being Luminary podcast, episode number 47.
I'm Robin Bevan. I'm a serving head teacher, secondary school in Essex, been there since 2007, which I think is unusual nowadays to have such a long serving period. Prior to that, served as a maths teacher, head of maths, deputy head. So that's a kind of one strand of me and who I am. To some people, I'm probably better known having served as the president of the National Education Union during the year that should have been a sabbatical for me, but was the year when COVID hit and I found myself running a school and doing all the NEU work online during that year. So that was quite an experience. So it's those two strands that probably bring me most obviously into this conversation.
Thanks, Robin. And I'm sure we'll get there, but how did you get into the NEU role?
Oh, gosh, the honest answer to that question goes right back to my father and my grandfather, if I'm honest, because, and we may reflect on this a little bit later, because both of my parents and my dad's dad were active trade unionists. And when you're growing up in that kind of environment, you view it as normal. You don't see as a child the view of your world from the outside. You see it only from inside. And although there wasn't anything that people would have seen as kind of overt political activity, there were some assumptions around how you behaved, what you did, how you listened to people, who you included. And that then kind of carried with me into young adulthood. And at university, I got involved in just representing other people, got involved in electoral processes, just low level, nothing big. Then I go off into work. I didn't go straight into teaching, but my journey elsewhere was brief, so we won't bother about that. I found my home in teaching relatively swiftly. And within a relatively short space of time across the first couple of schools I worked in, I saw members of staff who were not being treated as well as they could have been. They weren't being treated badly. I don't want to be unfair on necessarily the leaders of those schools, but there were people who needed representation, needed support. And I thought, well, I've got a voice. For whatever reason, I can stay calm under pressure. I can listen to people. I can use that. And so it wasn't long before I became a union rep. You become a union rep, you start doing work on behalf of other people to help them and to help schools be good employers. And then you get invited to local meetings, and then you say yes to going to conference. And this would have been back in the 1990s. And then you speak at a conference and you discover that you do have voice and influence through collective organizations, democratic collective organizations. And that was mainly through the old union, the ATL, that will be known to some people listening in, but times have changed and ATL and NUT came together. An amalgamation that I was very pleased to champion and was involved in some of the background work for, to create the largest education trade union in Europe. And during that process, I got elected into the presidential cycle. So I put myself forward. So that's a little bit of the story mixed a bit. Yeah.
Great. So we're going to circle right back to some of those things, I'm sure. Really fascinated to hear about that, always that kind of spirit that sort of comes through the generations in a way. So and this question, this sort of first question I ask my guests is about diversity, equity, inclusion and how it manifests in your origin story. So maybe we could start with your origin story. Could you tell us a bit about where are you from, and super interested to hear about your granddad and your dad.
So I think we've got kind of two different stories, and I think they're both worth telling, because the starting point, I guess, possibly even for many people listening to this conversation, is why is Angie talking to a privileged, white, male, middle-class school leader about equality, diversity, and inclusion? You know, what is my voice in this story? And that's a fair question. It's an important question. And if you trace some of the markers of through my life, you would perhaps not expect for us to be having this conversation, and not necessarily expect for me, given that background, to necessarily be wanting to put forward a very strong voice into this space. Because I was raised in a relatively advantaged home. Both of my parents were graduates. Unusually for the early 70s, my mum was also in full-time work, so as was my dad. One of four children. I went to a state grammar school, went from there to do my first degree at Oxford. Even that little phrase, my first degree, kind of just kind of says, okay, so this guy's done that sort of work. And it was a very privileged journey. However, and this is where I'm going to kind of loop back on it a little bit, I kind of realized that probably from the age of maybe 15, 16, 17, that if you have advantage, if you have power, whether it is there by virtue of merit or whether it's there by virtue of the way society is organized, that you can either use that power, that influence, that voice to help transform the world into the world that you want to see, or you can use it to shore things up to your own advantage. And although that's a kind of a fairly bleak split between the two, I also became convinced that if you do nothing, that is a political act. If you sit on the sidelines and you are not engaged in using the talents that you have ultimately for the well-being of others, then you're actually contributing to maintaining the status quo. You're not seeking change. And then you have to ask, well, where does that kind of radical perspective come from? And that's where you go back into, for me, into childhood. There are then two more elements that are worth throwing into that story. One, my parents had, and perhaps this is not a surprise, a loose affiliation with the nonconformist church movement, but never expected. There was no, we were encouraged to attend church, but there was no expectation around the beliefs we ultimately adopted. And I eventually found a kind of home for that aspect of life in Quakerism, in a place where you can affirm the spiritual beliefs of others, but not place upon them a requirement to have a particular perspective, and that all others have something of God in them. And if somebody turns around to me as a scientific atheist and says that's a whole load of, you know, nonsense, then that's fine. But what it is a metaphor or a narrative that we can live by that helps us to work towards a society that is more inclusive, more wholesome, more equal. And so there was that element. And the other piece, I guess, is around some of those people, the people I met at university. And my experience of university was predominantly white. And once again, at that time, not a surprise, particularly. We are talking mid-1980s. But what I did encounter was women who were reading good feminist literature, talking about it. And that gave me the beginnings of a language around power and influence and the need to privilege those who are underprivileged, to advantage those who are disadvantaged, to give a voice to those who are silent. And that put all those pieces together, and then working in a teaching environment, and you do absolutely end up in a place where you are wanting to use the influence you've got for constructive betterment. So it's a kind of a mixed story, but you know.
How do you feel you move these concerns, these interests on diversity, equity, inclusion into your work, either as a teacher or into the role that you do as a unionist?
I'll talk mainly about school, and that's really because I think the trade union movement has been towards the forefront of advancing the interests of peoples with different stories to tell. So, and there's a time lag. I think we have to accept that there's a time lag in society between an idea becoming resonant. So whether that's advances in relation to women and women's equality, you can see the kind of progression over time. And in fact, if we look backwards over history, those narratives of social progression are one of the biggest sources of encouragement, I think, for all of us in the middle of a time when things look like they're going pretty grim in many, many respects. Things have been grim before, but the narrative, the overall narrative of social progression is there. In the 70s and 80s, the narrative was around multiculturalism, a language and a concept that kind of began to make inroads, and then people shifted that language and moved forwards in terms of how they were thinking about concepts of race equality. And then, I mean, this was part of my time at university. You had the Thatcher driven reforms that were anti-LGBT in relation to clause, I think it was clause 28, and possibly more recently advances in relation to the rights and inclusion of disabled people as well. So you've got those strands, and they're strong within the trade union movement, and the trade union movement wouldn't be what it is if they weren't. But within a school context, I think there are several things that are worth, they're just kind of very practical, I guess. So the first thing when I became a head was that I noticed was that the pupil intake to the school did not fully reflect the communities we served. And that just kind of caused me to raise some eyebrows about why. And indeed, at the time I took over as head, I think I'm right in saying that the staff were all white. And both of those things just act as prompts in your thinking. Firstly, it's important to observe it, to notice it, to recognize it, and to ask questions about it. And just on a little deviation, I was talking about those two experiences that hit me in relation to Michael's story and in relation to the town in South Wales and then Vinnie Lander. Add into that, and I read it, I think it was 2 years ago, that 40% of secondary schools in England have no non-white staff. You know, now that figure may have changed in the time, but that cannot be right. There must be, there must be structural barriers, there must be hidden limitations on the employment and progression of people from different cultures and heritages if you're in that position. You know, there has to be. So the first thing that I did, and it was fairly gentle, we started collecting information from parents of pupils in our school about the reasons they chose the school. Which is fairly normal, kind of, you know, sort of, there's a soft edge to it, which is around marketing, but there's also a stronger edge, which is about making sure that you are meeting the needs of those pupils as best you can within the school. And we saw that there were certain messages that seemed to be going through our marketing that we probably hadn't kind of fully registered. And they weren't explicit in any shape or form, but they were implicitly exclusive. Yeah. And so we changed the way we did some of our recruitment materials, and we started including into the recruitment materials stories of pupils who came to our school, and being really specific to include stories of pupils who were coming from different cultures and heritages, because we started looking at the languages that the pupils spoke as well within the school, or at least within their home lives. And we even though the school was not anything like as varied as the South End and wider community, we'd still got 15 different home languages, which we hadn't kind of properly registered or celebrated. And within a short space of time, we saw that shift occurring. We only had to give permission. We only had to make people welcome. And in terms of staffing, that also was just very gentle. And it leads me actually to another one of these kind of realizations. When you are advancing views about equality, diversity, inclusion within the workplace, when you are talking about overcoming some of the structural barriers, you get a lot of people who respond with the word "but." You know, but you don't want to, you know, you want to make sure you get the best candidate, you know. And there are all these buts that get thrown in there.
So they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah. and it's similar. Let's go for the, during the continuing period of campaigning around Black Lives Matter, you know, you would hear people say, but white lives matter too. And the use of the word "but" is poisonous in that context, and you've kind of reflected it back, because the word that should be in there, if you're going to say it at all, is "and," because actually what we're saying is, yes, this is true, and also this is true, but right at the moment, folks, we've got an imbalance that looks like this. So although these are both true, we need to be looking to redress it.
Thank you for listening to the Being Luminary podcast. I would love to hear your thoughts on the podcast, so please do leave us a review. Each month, I will be picking one of our reviewers to get a free laser coaching session as a thank you. And remember, if you know a luminary or an everyday thought leader who would benefit from listening to this podcast, or who would love to be featured on the cast, then please do share it with them. This episode was presented by me, Angie Brown. Original music is by Martin Ostwick. The series is edited by Big Tent Media and produced by Emily Crosby Media.